So we're going to move on now and talk about urothelial bladder cancer. Really incredible how much has been happening in this field right now. It's going to be challenging to even get through all this in the time that we have, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what the faculty has to say about this, and particularly about the issue of cell-free DNA that's really come out into the open over the last year or so, I think. So we're really happy today to have Dr. Terry Friedlander from the UCSF Helen Dillard Comprehensive Cancer Center in San Francisco, and Dr. Dan Petrylak from the Yale Comprehensive Cancer Center in New Haven, Connecticut. We also have Gus Fonseca from the Florida Cancer Specialists in La Canto, Florida. So welcome to you all. So one of the things we've been talking about this, I decided to put into ChatGPT and ask, like, what were the best papers of the year in oncology in the last year? And then we started doing it for each tumor type. So I just want to start out with you, Terry, in terms of what sticks in your mind as some of the highlights over the past year. We're going to get into a lot of this, but particularly in terms of practice changing.
Yeah, so I think the studies of enfortumab vedotin, to me, jump out as probably the most practice changing. There have been two trials in the neoadjuvant space, both in cisplatin-eligible patients as well as in cisplatin-ineligible patients. Randomized phase threes, both markedly positive, like very high hazard ratios in favor of EVP. And it's really become the standard of care now for frontline treatment. I'm actually going to talk about platinum and PD-1, but in reality, I think Dan's going to talk to us more about that. So I think that's really exciting.
Dan, what were your highlights of the year?
Well, I would agree with that. I think that the EV Pembro studies have now opened up a new frontier for the neoadjuvant treatment of bladder cancer. We never had a combination therapy for cisplatin ineligible patients, and now 30% of patients are not eligible to receive cisplatin. That's now opened up. I think the circulating tumor DNA data also is very, very exciting. We now can basically select those patients who it's appropriate to give adjuvant therapy for. So I think those are the two main areas.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Actually, ChatGPT agrees with you as well. Gus, I know you're very involved with clinical research. Any exciting urothelial bladder trials you're doing now?
Well, literally, we just... Following this, we thought that therefore we should now start using it even earlier. So we just opened a clinical trial with a group of, we have some urologists in the FCS system as well. They are perfectly willing to let us now reconsider whether cystectomy is really a right option. Therefore, we're going to be starting to use EV Pembro versus the standard in those patients who decided against cystectomy or were ineligible, which would have been chemo radiation therapy, EV Pembro.
So, you know, and also just to kind of put it in perspective, Dan, in terms of EV, and we'll talk about this, but again, just to sort of set the stage in terms of EV Pembro, I mean, we talked about neoadjuvant as well, but the results of metastatic disease are also amazing, particularly in terms of the tail on the curve. Any comments on that and why? Any thoughts about why? I mean, we see a lot of combination of ADC and IO, but this one really is spectacular.
Well, it's really remarkable. You know, we see a doubling of the complete response rate, a doubling of the median survival, and we know from the laboratory that MMAE, the antitubulin agent that's part of EV Pembro, will actually induce dendritic cells and cause other immune effects. So there's a synergy between the two in that particular situation, which I don't think we appreciate with other ADCs.
So, all right, well, let's talk about it. And Dan was mentioning about cell-free DNA. I've had a bunch of conversations over the past year with Tom Powles from the UK, who's really been a leader in this. In fact, I always point to urothelial bladder cancer as sort of the current leader in terms of cell-free DNA. You guys are way ahead of a lot of other solid tumors. So, Terry, let's talk about what we know.
Sure. So we're learning a lot, both in the non-metastatic space for both NMIBC as well as muscle-invasive disease. And so we'll talk about how ctDNA is fitting into this. These are my disclosures. So first I'm going to talk about non-muscle invasive disease, why we're giving PD-1 plus BCG. We're going to talk about three randomized phase three trials, CREST, Potomac, and ALBIN, which were just reported this year. And then we'll talk about use of pembrolizumab as monotherapy in this group. And then I'm going to switch gears and talk about some of the MIBC studies, including the Niagara study, which is a study of cisplatin-based chemo plus durvalumab, the IMvigor011 study, which really gets to your question, Neil, about the role of circulating tumor DNA and guiding our therapy, and then think about how we're using cell-free DNA to both as for prognostic and predictive purposes. So in NMIBC, I think most people know BCG is the standard of care. It's been so for about 40, almost 50 years now. The challenge with BCG, though, is that even though it cures a lot of patients, there's about 50% of patients who don't get cured, who relapse, and ultimately are recommended to get cystectomy, which is a major surgery and morbid and really causes a lot of challenges. So why should we give PD-1 with BCG? So we know immunologically, when you treat bladder tumors with BCG, PD-L1 gets upregulated. This is a counter-inflammatory response to sort of damp down all the inflammation from the BCG, and that when the cells become resistant, there's often T-cell exhaustion. You can see this in the graph here. Clinically, it makes sense to give two therapies together. We might avoid cystectomy, BCG addressing the localized disease, and PD-L1 maybe addressing micrometastatic disease. There's a lot of rationale to give these therapies together. And I think it's important to think about the patient perspective. This was a survey of patients with localized bladder cancer, and you can see the vast majority really want to avoid cystectomy. And as an oncologist, I want them to avoid cystectomy as well. And I think, Gus, you sort of mentioned this about some ongoing studies. And we really want to keep that in mind. So these are the three trials in the NMIBC space that are really important to know about. The first one's the CREST study, the second the Potomac, and the third the Albin study. And complicated slide, I know, but I really just want to highlight that each of these studies randomized patients to get BCG induction and maintenance along with a PD-1 inhibitor. And they were compared to BCG induction and maintenance alone. The first two trials also had a BCG induction-only arm. I'm not going to talk about that. The results weren't that good. So it's really about the addition of PD-1 to BCG induction and maintenance. And as you can see, the three studies had slightly different designs. The first two trials gave 2 years of BCG. The Albin study, which was ultimately negative, only gave 1 year of BCG. There were different amounts of PD-1 given in these two trials. Now, when we look at the data, you can see both CREST and Potomac were positive for their primary endpoint of event-free survival. Identical hazard ratios, interestingly. The overall survival data is not mature. I do think it's important for the CREST study that you can see the point estimate is above 1. And I think that may have hampered the ability for sasanlimab, which is a subcutaneous PD-1, to get an FDA approval. It's not yet FDA approved, unlike durvalumab, which is approved across a lot of oncology. And you can see the Albin study was negative for OS as well. So slightly different studies, slightly different results. Why do we have these differences? So I know, again, a busy slide, but I think if we just look across the slide, you can see that the first two studies were large studies. There were over 1,000 patients each. Albin was much smaller. And both of the first two studies had a high percentage of patients with T1 disease, which tends to respond better to immune checkpoint inhibitors. They also gave more BCG maintenance, and there were different definitions of EFS between the trials. And that may have all sort of together contributed to the first two trials being positive, the Albin study being negative. Interestingly, toxicity rates are pretty comparable across these three trials. So how do we put this together? I think that sasanlimab or durvalumab in combination with BCG may become options as the first-line therapy for patients with high-risk NMIBC. Again, the population really, the T1 high-risk population seems to get the most benefit, and there's a separate study of pembrolizumab, KEYNOTE-676, in this patient population. The big question as we sort of take this to the clinic is this worth it? Is the juice worth the squeeze? So we have positive EFS, immature OS, and real toxicity. I think this will allow some patients to avoid cystectomy, which is a really good goal. That's what we want to get to. But, you know, there are other later line therapies available for NMIBC, and maybe we can salvage the people who need it and avoid giving PD-1 to people who don't. And the last question is, who's going to be giving this therapy? Because this is now, you know, these patients are traditionally treated by urologists. So are medical oncologists going to be giving the PD-1? Or are we going to have surgeons giving PD-1 and managing what's potentially serious PD-1 toxicity, hypophysitis, hepatitis, nephritis, et cetera? So there's a lot of unanswered questions here.
Before we go on, I'm just kind of curious, and just in terms of these trials you're talking about right now, Dan, first of all, if you notice there, the grade 3 toxicity was like 23, 24%.
Exactly.
I don't know, maybe some of that's from the BCG, Dan, but that seems pretty high.
It is high, and I think we've seen the same trend in kidney cancer when we're giving adjuvant checkpoint therapy. So it is a high rate of toxicity, and of course needs to be monitored carefully. And I think, as Dr. Friedlander is saying, you know, the question is the toxicity up front versus looking at some of these other agents later on. And there's some more exciting agents that we'll see later in the presentation that warrant evaluation.
I don't know if you've actually seen patients where this was on the table, but is this something you recommend?
Right now, no. We don't have FDA approval in this particular area, so I don't recommend it at this particular point.
All right, let's keep going now in terms of BCG unresponsive.
Yeah, so you know, can we save the PD-1 inhibitor? That makes a little more sense, really treat the people who need it. So the KEYNOTE-057 study, this was reported a number of years ago. This is just a single-arm study of BCG unresponsive patients. The slide's very busy, but it's actually a very straightforward study. What we saw in this study is that there's activity, maybe not surprising. You can see for patients who have carcinoma in situ, which tends to be high risk, about 41% of them had CR rates at 3 months. If you look at the shape of these curves, it ends up being about 10 to 20% of patients have long-term durable benefit, which is what we see for most PD-1 inhibitors across bladder cancer. I have patients who are on this therapy, who've been on this therapy for like 5 years and have stopped therapy and have never had recurrence, so they're super happy. They've kept their bladders. That's great. There was an update where they looked at patients who didn't have CIS, and they saw very similar data that's on the right of the slide here. You know, about a third of patients were still free of progression after 3 years. So I think that there is a role for PD-1 as monotherapy. You have to balance this against the side effects. And as I mentioned, this is now FDA approved for BCG unresponsive NMIBC. But as we were talking about, there's a lot of options for patients who have unresponsive disease. And this is a busy slide. I think Dr. Petrock is going to talk a little bit more about this. I want to highlight on the left, nadofaragene firadenovec is basically a recombinant virus that expresses immune inflammatory signals. That's approved for refractory NMIBC. TAR-200, which we'll hear about a lot more, is an intravesical gemcitabine delivery device. So it's really just gemcitabine being given in another way. And then all the way on the right of the screen, NAI plus BCG, this is an IL-15 superagonist. So it's another immune therapy that can also have activity in late-line bladder cancer. So the field is a little upset in a good way because we have all these novel agents, and the question is how to combine them. Also, the cost of these agents is incredible. High. Patients get cystoscopy frequently for many, many weeks and months and years, and this is one of the most challenging diseases to treat from a cost perspective. So we have to factor that into our thinking.
Gus, any thoughts about, you mentioned that you work with some urologists giving PD, I mean, PD-1's been out there, Pembro's been out there, non-muscle invasive disease. It doesn't sound like a great idea for them.
It just gave me a shock when someone mentioned urologists giving these medications where grade 3 immunological toxicities would have been experienced, at least in... And I think it probably is because of the inflammatory process, although I did not realize that in kidney also that was the case of such high degrees of inflammatory processes. But I definitely will be calling them, but not to give the drug. I mean, they did call us many years ago when Pembro was all the rage, and they did send those patients, but it actually fizzled out. The single agent Pembro for the BCG non-responsive, it fizzled out because it was hard to tell if they really we'd been spared, and they just had so many cystoscopies, and the monitoring was like something, you know, we saw disease, I didn't see disease, but the P53 is positive. It was a very confusing time for us as medical oncologists with the urologist.
Yeah, we actually did a program at AUA last year on AKT inhibition for the urologist because you have capivasertib and prostate cancer maybe coming on. Anyhow, let's keep going now with BCG resistance in terms of the trials out there.
Sure. So this is obviously another busy slide. I think it's useful maybe to look at this paper just to say that there's a lot of trials going on. There's intravesical studies, systemic studies, lots of combinations. So as I mentioned before, I think we're going to see more. Cristimogene is another virus, that genetically modified virus that's had pretty good data in phase 2 and now phase 3. And there's others listed here. So this is, come back next year and we're going to have a different discussion, I think. I want to switch gears, though, and move into the MIBC space. So there's been positive phase 3 data here as well, both just as sort of straightforward trial data as well as using ctDNA, and I'll dive into this here. So we have six major trials in muscle-invasive bladder cancer that have either reported or will report. I'm going to focus on the Niagara study, which was done in the cisplatin-eligible population. Dr. Petrylak will be talking about the EV-303 and 304 trials using enfortumab vedotin. So the Niagara study was the first of these trials to report. Very straightforward study. So patients had muscle-invasive disease, going for cystectomy, and were cisplatin-eligible. They either got cisplatin and gemcitabine in the control arm, or they got that plus durvalumab. The durvalumab was given four cycles neoadjuvant plus up to a year of adjuvant, so basically a year total. And then they were followed for primary endpoints of EFS and complete response rate, and OS was a secondary endpoint. And so what we saw with the study was positive. So the EFS, the primary endpoint, has a ratio of 0.68. So we're clearly preventing relapses by giving durvalumab. CR rate was better, about 10%, you know, delta, 10% difference when we give durvalumab in the neoadjuvant context. And the OS was better with a hazard ratio of 0.75. So met all the metrics we wanted to, and this actually became an NCCN Category 1 approved regimen. So it's out there, it's possible, it's helpful in some contexts. I will say before I talk about cell-free DNA that the EV Pembro data is very strong as well. And so take this with a grain of salt and please listen to Dr. Petrylak's presentation about EVP, because I think there's a lot to say for EVP in this context. And I don't use this regimen very much now that we have enfortumab plus pembrolizumab in this space. What's pretty cool about this study, the Niagara study, was that every patient had Natera, Signatera test done, or almost all the patients did, to evaluate cell-free DNA. And what we saw was cell-free DNA or circulating tumor DNA was very prognostic. Patients after surgery, that's what I'm showing you here, if their cell-free DNA was positive, and this is a tumor-informed assay based on their tumor, if it was positive, they almost uniformly all relapsed from the disease. You can see that if they were negative, they had better outcomes. If they got durvalumab, both groups had better outcomes. So cell-free DNA positive patients were spared relapses because they got the durvalumab, but there was also some improvement in the ctDNA negative patients. So this shows you as a prognostic marker that cell-free DNA is incredibly helpful. It's almost like a PSA for bladder cancer. You know, if it's positive after surgery, the patient is in trouble. So the IMvigor011 study was also presented last year at ESMO. This was a follow-on to the IMvigor010 study, which I won't say so much about, but that was an adjuvant study of atezolizumab. This study went back and said, can we use cell-free DNA to stratify patients and maybe assign therapy to the highest risk patients? And so in this study, patients had surgery and then entered the trial. They were monitored for up to a year with serial assessments of circulating tumor DNA. If it was negative, which is in the green boxes at the bottom, over the course of the year, they were just monitored with surveillance. If at any point the cell-free DNA after surgery was positive, then they were randomized on the top one-to-one to get atezolizumab or placebo, and then they were monitored. And so what we saw in this study was that, that patients who were cell-free DNA negative actually did very well. Only about 11-12% of them ever relapsed, and the overall survival was excellent. So when I have a patient who's post-op and is negative for cell-free DNA over the course of the year, that's an excellent sign. They're very likely cured. Only a minority are going to relapse. What we saw, though, is that patients who were cell-free DNA positive, again, are in trouble, but if they got PD-1 therapy, they did better. And so this now becomes a predictive marker. It tells us if they're positive and they get a PD-1 therapy, they're going to do better. And so it's a good way to sort of risk stratify our patients. And that applies for the DFS on the left as well as the OS on the right. So very practice informing, I would say. I don't use adjuvant atezolizumab for a lot of reasons that I've sort of mentioned already, especially because the EV Pembro data gives perioperative PD-1, and that data looks even stronger. In a sense, this was a great study to prove the value of cell-free DNA. I think it's probably one of the best trials out there. This was in the New England Journal of Medicine just this year. The other piece about this study is that circulating tumor DNA levels matter, and this was data from the trial that was presented at GU ASCO this year, and they broke down recurrence rates based on the amount of cell-free DNA. It's the first time I've ever seen a study like this in phase three, and what you can see is that the patients who have the most level of circulating tumor DNA have the worst outcomes. That's the darkest color on the left, and patients who have progressively less have better outcomes. So it sort of suggests that maybe we can even risk stratify within the cell-free DNA positive patients moving forward. Again, hypothesis generating, we need to evaluate into more studies, but there's clearly a difference here. It's almost like patients with a higher PSA post-prostatectomy probably do worse.
One quick question about the patients who are ctDNA negative, and then I want to see if Gus has any questions. If you follow the patient, they start out ctDNA negative, and then they turn positive. I don't know what they did in the trial. I think they were treated. But is that, if do people do just as well if you just wait for them to turn positive and then treat? Do we know that?
Yeah, so I think the outcomes are fairly similar no matter when they turned positive.
Right.
Obviously, prognostically, it was worse to turn positive than to just be negative the whole time. But it does suggest you could monitor these patients and maybe give adjuvant therapy in that space. I think where the field is today, though, as we're going to learn from the EVP studies, is that everybody gets treated and they don't stratify in those trials based on cell-free DNA. So we need a next generation of trials to look at like the timing of using this and whether we can sort of de-escalate therapy for patients.
And Dan, would you be tempted if you could, I don't know, regulatory-wise or access-wise, to use EV Pembro, for example, rather than just atezolizumab in a patient who's MRD positive?
Well, we'll see from the EV-303 and 304 studies that we actually do use that in the adjuvant setting afterwards. But for a patient who may have just had chemotherapy, no, because they think that we just don't have any evidence to use it in that situation.
So on the other hand, as you say, it's like PSA. You know they're going to recur. So Gus, any questions, any comments?
Yeah, well, as you may guess, we tend to see other diseases, and therefore we cannot avoid just making analogy comparisons. In breast, we have prognosis score, recurrence scores, but there are different technologies. In the GI, for example, if they use tumor-bespoken versus free DNA, we all call them ctDNA, but are we in all these studies using tumor-bespoken tests? Because I think we need to start identifying them as such, otherwise we get confused, because when we walk out, the drug reps will, the lab reps sure. will tell us about their technology.
Yeah, I mean, almost all these studies have used the Signatera test from Natera, so it's bespoke. The tumor tissue's taken, sequenced, the mutations are identified, and then probes are designed specifically for that patient. Okay. Blood is taken at a later time point. Those probes are used to identify the patient's specific tumor DNA, and there's a sort of a kind of biologic, you know, makes sense to do that.
Sure.
Whether this works with non-bespoke assays, I think, is less well known because it's just not been embedded in most of our phase three trials.
Yeah, last night we did a program on lymphoma. I was amazed. They were talking about doing actually Signatera in lymphoma.
Yep.
And if you think about it, it makes sense. You just want to look at, doesn't matter whether it's heme or solid tumor, you want to look at the tumor and then use that to figure out whether it's come back. So, interesting. How about this Alliance study?
Yeah, so this is the modern trial, which is ongoing. If you don't have it open and you have C bladder patients, it's really very reasonable to consider opening it. This is a study that takes patients post-cystectomy and then randomizes them, or I should say assesses cell-free DNA levels. If on the bottom, if they're negative, they're randomized to nivolumab or surveillance. If they turn positive, then they get nivolumab. On the flip side, if they're cell-free DNA positive, the study's asking, can we do more than just give a PD-1 inhibitor? Mm-hmm. And in this study, the patients are randomized to nivolumab on top or nivolumab relatimab, which is a LAG-3 inhibitor. And we'll see if a sort of dual immunotherapy has benefit compared to just giving Nivo alone. This is going to be amended, I think, because of the EVP data, because so many patients are going to be getting that. So this may change in the future. But this is a sort of one of the, I think, most important studies using cell-free DNA to guide therapy. And so just to finish off, this is my last slide, I think combo immune therapy and chemotherapy is effective. Technically, Gem/Cis/Durva is a standard of care, although I think the periop EVP data is very compelling, and hopefully you can make a decision after you hear Dr. Petrylak talk about that. I think the tumor-informed circulating tumor DNA really helps identify our patients, risk stratify our patients. We have more data coming in from the EV trials. We haven't seen much yet. Also, the VOLGA study, which is a study of EV plus durvalumab plus minus tremelimumab, a CTLA-4 inhibitor. We're going to get data from that. And really, I think of cell-free DNA as a tool, and it's going to help us personalize our therapies and hopefully really assign the right treatment to the right patient.
So, Dan, just to bring in another issue, I don't know how often you see people with contraindications to IOs, maybe prior transplant, prior autoimmune disease. If you have a patient you really do not want to give an IO to, how does that affect your approach?
Well, I look at cisplatin eligibility, of course. If they do have a contraindication to immune therapy, then I'll give GemCis or dose-dense MVAC in that particular situation. I won't give them a checkpoint at that point. So I'll use standard chemotherapy in those patients.
Any other comments, Terry, in terms of, again, people with prior autoimmune disease? Are there situations you run out of options, you see such great results? Would you give it in a patient who had a prior renal transplant?
Yeah, so I actually have patients who have autoimmune disease who I've used the checkpoint inhibitors in. I'm sure we probably all have to some degree. It's tricky in the perioperative space because this is technically curable. They might get cured with no PD-1. So I think it's about like sort of assessing how serious is the autoimmune disease. Are they just on, for example, an NSAID for psoriatic arthritis, or are they on an IL-17 inhibitor? And I might treat those patients a little differently. I mean, we can manage most autoimmune toxicities for most of our patients if we watch closely, but you really have to be vigilant. Mm-hmm. At UCSF, we actually have a immunotherapy toxicity clinic. So when patients get these sort of strange toxicities, we're not sure what to do, we can actually kind of refer patients there. But, you know, that's not available to everyone. So I think you have to be cautious.
Gus, I don't know whether you have autoimmune clinics around here, but curious, any questions about, again, autoimmune toxicity?
I mean, I would love as a clinician to be, honestly, to be dropped cisplatin because if you get burned more than once with someone losing the kidney function, I would always prefer to give them, therefore, EV Pembro, for example. But no, this is a challenging situation of whether to choose one versus the other ones because our local internists pretty much are going to let us take care of all the autoimmune side effects.
All right, so Dan, let's continue on, and we'll get into the EV Pembro more.
Terrific. So this, as we said before, is a very exciting time. My disclosures, I'm not sure why it wasn't there, but, well, anyway, they're a matter of public record. So as we know, there are newer ways of administering drugs in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. This is what is referred to as the pretzel. It's a small plastic device where you can put different chemotherapeutic agents, such as gemcitabine or erdafitinib, and you can actually give a sustained dose of a drug to a patient with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. The advantage is that you don't have to put a catheter in constantly. The patient doesn't have to rotate themselves to give proper drug exposure. And this is basically administered every 3 weeks. In the preliminary studies with gemcitabine-eluting TAR-200, the complete response rate was 83%. Overall, and the responses were rapid. 98% of the CRs were seen at the first assessment at 12 weeks. So there have been a number of trials that have looked at this in the randomized fashion. This is looking at TAR-200, which is gemcitabine, combined with cetralumab and cetralumab alone and BCG, unresponsive, high-risk, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. As we see, there are three arms to this particular study. If we look at the centrally assessed complete response rates at any time, the monotherapy is 83%. If we look at the combination therapy, it's 67%, and cetralimumab alone is 46%. That's consistent with what Terry said before about pembrolizumab. The interesting thing is the durability does seem to be a little bit better with the combination therapy. If we look at cohort number one, we see that the estimated 12-month duration of response is 75%. With monotherapy with TAR-200, 65%, and the cetralimumab monotherapy, 48.5%. Again, what we see with other checkpoints, very, very consistent. Now, one of the KEYNOTE-905 trial, moving on to muscle-invasive bladder cancer. As we see here, KEYNOTE-905, EV-303, looked at those patients who had muscle-invasive urothelial carcinoma. They were cisplatin ineligible by Galski criteria, although about 10% of patients refused cisplatin-based chemotherapy and went on the study. And the stratification factors on this trial were cisplatin eligibility, clinical stage, as well as regions. And patients were randomized to receive EV Pembro or radical cystectomy. And that's the standard of care for cisplatin-ineligible patients. So the primary endpoint was event-free survival by a blinded review committee. As we see on top, the two-year event-free survival was 74.7% versus 39% for those patients who received cystectomy alone. The hazard ratio is 0.4. It's interesting, if we look at the cystectomy alone patients, this is very, very similar to what we saw with the neoadjuvant data with MVAC a number of years ago, where patients had about a 40% two-year relapse-free survival rate. What I think is impressive here is the overall survival. The hazard ratio is 0.5. If we see, again, about 80% of patients at 2 years are alive versus 63% in those patients who just simply receive cystectomy alone. In the past, we've correlated pathological complete response with overall survival. As we see on the left-hand portion of this particular slide, a significantly better pathological complete response rate. It's about a 48% difference versus cystectomy alone. So why would you expect patients to have a complete response with cystectomy? Well, they have a TURBT. They've had a scraping of their bladder beforehand. So that, in some patients, will render them without muscle-invasive disease. But nonetheless, 57% versus 8.6%, significant difference. We see this very similar treatment-related adverse events that we see in the metastatic setting: rash, neuropathy, fatigue, hyperglycemia. Those are the major ones we see with EV Pembro. And remember that we're only giving four cycles of treatment with this particular study. It's three cycles in the other study. Talk about in a moment. So these, again, are adverse events of interest: skin reactions, peripheral neuropathy, ocular disorders. I don't really commonly see that, but 17% of patients in this particular study. Hyperglycemia, 9.8%. Over the long term, you can see hypothyroidism. These are the types of events you see with checkpoint therapy. So EV-304, these are cisplatin-eligible patients. And these patients were randomized to receive either enfortumab plus pembrolizumab or gemcitabine and cisplatinum. If they were on the experimental arm, they were eligible to receive adjuvant therapy with EV Pembro. The adjuvant therapy was up to 13 cycles of pembrolizumab and 6 cycles of EV. And this was compared to observation. So there was no adjuvant checkpoint in the control arm, as we would do normally in our practice. And, of course, all the patients in the experimental arm were eligible to receive adjuvant therapy. So generally, for those patients with a pathological complete response or those patients who may have negative circulating tumor DNA, we may not give those patients adjuvant therapy. But for this particular study, all patients received adjuvant therapy. Hmm. So again, I think what's remarkable is the consistency of this data. Look at the 24-month event-free survival, 80%, exactly what we saw in the previous trial. If we look at those patients in the GEM-CIS arm, 66.2%. Overall survival, significantly different. Hazard ratio of 0.65 in favor of EV Pembro. And then treatment-related adverse events, similar to what we saw in the other trial. So AEs of special interest, again, the same thing. Skin reactions, 63% of patients. Peripheral neuropathy, 36% of patients. Ocular disorders, 23% of patients overall.
So I wanted to ask Terry, you know, it's one thing to take a look at data like this, particularly in toxicity. It's the other thing to sort of visualize what's going to happen to the patient. Can you provide a little more granular input about what happens to people in EV Pembro, the type particularly related to the enfortumab, for practical purposes, what you do to prevent toxicity, how you manage it, what will cause you to hold the drug?
Sure. So enfortumab targets Nectin-4, which is expressed on the surface of bladder cancer cells, widely expressed in the skin and in the eye. So patients get rashes. They get this sort of mild eye toxicity. I think it's about educating the patient well ahead of time. The patient's spouse, the patient's child or parent or whoever's in the room, talk about rashes. Patients can die from Stevens-Johnson syndrome, toxic epidermal necrolysis. So we have to be really careful about that. I often give patients trampsin alone or a similar steroid cream ahead of time. So tell them just to use it so they're not calling me at 5 p.m. on a Friday with a grade 1 rash and not sure what to do. But if they have blistering, oral sores, unexplained liver kidney issues. That could be a sign of real toxicity. The other challenge is that MMAE can cause peripheral neuropathy. It's pretty dose dependent. It's actually just like giving a taxane. If you give enough taxane, most people get neuropathic. And so it's about recognizing that, asking them about it, having them literally button their shirt in front of you and make sure that they can still have dexterity. The MMAE also rarely can cause hyperglycemia, and actually EV is contraindicated in patients with an A1C above 8 or blood sugar above 250, and we have to make sure we check that. People forget that, and in the phase 1 study, there were deaths due to hyperglycemia and ketoacidosis. Those are the main things to look out for. Rarely they can get pneumonitis, but that's pretty rare.
So we actually did an entire CME program recently on hyperglycemia and the oncology nowadays, because there are a bunch of drugs. We're going to talk about some tomorrow morning in breast cancer. But if you have a patient who has diabetes, maybe their hemoglobin A1C is above 8, will you treat them for the diabetes, bring it down, and then treat them? Will you use a GLP drug?
Yeah, so I actually had this just recently. I had a patient whose A1C was like 10, and he just wasn't taking any of his meds. And I said, look, I can't give you this drug. We actually started him on carboplatin gemcitabine for about 2 or 3 cycles, got him to see the endocrinologist. He got on metformin, and his A1C went down to like 7.5. And then we switched, and he's still alive today, now about 2 years later. Still on drug, and so you can get people there, but I wouldn't give EV to somebody with an A1C that's out of control.
Also, we'll talk about this with breast. You know, these new continuous glucose monitors are so valuable to really get a granular feeling of what's going on. So, Dan, real simple question. Right now, let's put aside reimbursement issues, sort of based on the data we have there. What do you consider an ideal approach to neoadjuvant therapy and patients who go to cystectomy first adjuvant treatment?
So in my mind, the ideal approach to neoadjuvant therapy is 3 or 4 cycles of EV Pembro. Now, we don't really see much of a difference in the pathological complete response rate between the two different trials. So I think that if you have a patient who's developing neuropathy or other side effects related to EV, I think it's acceptable to go 3 cycles and then go to cystectomy rather than giving that particular 4th cycle. So to me, that's the gold standard in terms of neoadjuvant therapy. Now, the real question lies in what do you do afterwards? If a patient has a pathological complete response rate, negative circulating tumor DNA, do you then go ahead and give them the adjuvant portion? We don't have a good answer to that. And the other thing I think it's very, very interesting, if you go back to the EV-302 data and look at those patients who are reevaluated for the second evaluation, those after 8 cycles of EVP, about a quarter of the patients who have a partial response convert to a complete response. So in certain patients, are we giving them enough EVP neoadjuvantly? So should we start thinking about trials of getting more EVP, or for those patients who have not responded, will they respond to further EVP in that situation? We don't have a good answer to that. But right now, EVP, with the possibility of adjuvant therapy, as we outlined in those trials, is standard of care.
So, Terry, what about, and I don't know how often you see this, and Gus, I don't know in community practice how often you see people who don't get adjuvant therapy, and then they present for consideration of adjuvant treatment. How are you managing that now?
Yeah, so we get some of those patients, they've gotten treated abroad, for example. I have patients come from China who just got a cystectomy and show up, and they're sort of like, what should I do now? There's not really great data. We have the data I showed about giving just an adjuvant checkpoint inhibitor. I think if they're very high risk, especially if they're cell-free DNA positive post-surgery, even though we didn't really see data here, I still think EVP, there's such strong data in the late-line setting in metastatic, in the early metastatic setting, and now in the perioperative setting, that it makes sense to give it, but it's a big informed discussion with the patient that we don't have level one evidence there. But I do think, you know, we see such strong data that it's a reasonable thing to consider. But, you know, Dan or Gus may have different, you know, different sort of feelings about that.
Gus, any questions or thoughts?
No, actually, I was just more reflecting on the duration of the EV preoperative, because to be honest, when you show that 50% pathologic response on the EV Pembro after 3 cycles, the first thing that went in my brain was, why not give them 6? And or particularly if you have circulating tumor DNA telling you that you are still in the right trend.
Dan?
Agreed. I mean, I think that that's something that we need to do for future studies, to look at those particular questions. Are we giving enough treatment? There are other studies now that are also looking at de-escalation of treatment afterwards. Do you need the cystectomy? I think that's really important.
Yeah, if we could de-escalate the EV because of the problems with the neuropathy and the rashes that it does, it's annoying, to say the least, it really would make our life so much better.
All right. I was just thinking, again, I think back to prostate cancer. You see a positive PSA, at some point they are going to relapse. Maybe it's going to be a while. And kind of starting to get that same vibe with cell-free DNA. Dan, biomarker testing and metastatic disease.
So akin to prostate cancer, we're now looking at biomarkers in metastatic urothelial carcinoma. And this may help us guide treatment after patients who've received EV Pembro in the neoadjuvant state. The real question is, do you reinduce them with EV Pembro? Do you go with a targeted therapy? Do you go with standard gem-cis or gem-carbo? We don't have good answers to that. But we do need to test our patients for markers. And unfortunately, over the past, we've really not done that. Overall, if we look at patients who were tested for FGFR3, we see that about 41% of patients received FGFR testing. Eventually, for those patients who are positive, about 30% of those patients receive erdafitinib. Now we have to start thinking about expanding our testing for HER2-new as well. Let's see. So as we know, FGFR3 is expressed in about 10% of urothelial carcinomas. We have an FDA-approved drug, erdafitinib, which targets FGFR3 mutations that was approved by an accelerated approval in 2019. And subsequently, there have been two trials that have been used to get the full approval of erdafitinib in patients with metastatic urothelial carcinoma. The first trial, THOR-1, compared erdafitinib to docetaxel in those patients who had received prior PD-1 or PD-L1 therapy. And then the cohort 2 of the THOR study looked at those patients who had no prior PD-L1 therapy and they were randomized to receive erdafitinib or pembrolizumab. As we see, this drug does have some challenges in terms of toxicity. Nail disorders, skin disorders, you must monitor the patient's phosphate levels and titrate the drug accordingly. Additionally, these patients require ophthalmologic examinations. Every 6 weeks is the standard, but they can develop central serous retinopathy, which can lead to blindness. And in that situation, of course, you need to stop therapy. But these are side effects that need to be monitored carefully. And in fact, one of the things that's being done now is giving erdafitinib using the pretzel, because we know that there's actually a high rate of FGFR3 expression in non-muscle invasive urothelial carcinoma, and that's a way of avoiding the systemic side effects in that situation. So this is cohort 1, erdafitinib randomized against standard chemotherapy. As we see, the chemotherapy arm is generally what you would expect for a taxane in this particular situation, a median survival of about 8 months. Erdafitinib is about 12 months, so certainly a superior median survival in this situation. HER2-new expression, this has been known for a long time in urothelial carcinoma. We see that from this particular slide, if you look at 3-plus positivity, it's about a third of patients overall. 18%, 2-plus is about a third of patients overall. And there are two ADCs that are being evaluated in metastatic urothelial carcinoma. First is trastuzumab deruxtecan. That is a drug that delivers a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor to the cells, and it's been looked at in breast cancer, GI tumors, as well as in non-small cell lung cancer. And then there's dasatinib vedotin, which is a drug that delivers MMAE to HER2-new positive cells. So here we have a little bit of an issue, of course, because if we're going to be giving enfortumab, which has MMAE and you develop side effects such as neuropathy and it's cumulative, there may be some trouble using this drug as a second-line agent. So the DESTINY pan-tumor study, DESTINY-2, looked at a number of different solid tumors, included of which were urothelial carcinoma. And these patients had to be either IHC 3 or 2+ to be entered in the study. They were allowed to have prior HER2 new targeting agents. As we see from the bladder cancer data, about a third of patients had a response to the trastuzumab deruxtecan, and the median survival is about 11 months. If we look at the side effects, one of the things that we have to look for is interstitial pneumonitis. Also, about a third of patients had grade 3 side effects. Dostatinib vedotin has also been evaluated in China in patients with metastatic urothelial carcinoma. If you look at both the HER2-new positive, 2-plus and 3-plus, versus the 1-plus or 0-plus, it's interesting that the median progression-free survival and overall survivals are very, very similar. For the 3-plus, it's 6 months, median survival of 14 months, and then 5.5 months and 16.4 months, respectively. So again, this looks very, very promising for these patients who have HER2-new, even those patients who are HER2-new low, even though it's a low number of patients overall. So this is a randomized trial that has been looking at dostatinib vedotin plus torlipimab, a checkpoint inhibitor, comparing that to gemcitabine, cis or carboplatinum. These patients were not permitted to have prior therapy, and they could have all forms of HER2-new expression, and they had to have an ECOG performance status of 0 or 1. So these are the data from this particular study. If we look at the chemotherapy arm, objective response rate of about 50%. Generally, that's what we see with the combination of gemcitabine and a platinum. Higher objective response rate in the combination experimental arm. Duration of response, 15 months versus 5.6 months. Progression-free survival, 13 months versus 6.5 months. 7-month difference, hazard ratio 0.36. And then the median overall survival, 31 months, very similar to what we see with EV Pembro in the situation, versus 16.9 months for those patients who receive chemotherapy, again, consistent with what we've seen with other data. So in conclusion, TAR-200 is a novel delivery system for gemcitabine in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. TAR-210, we alluded to before, will deliver erdafitinib and is now being evaluated in the Moonrise trials. EV Pembro demonstrates consistent pathological complete response rates of 60% in cisplatin-eligible and ineligible patients. We should think about second-line treatment in terms of biomarkers. We don't really know whether these are better, of course, than GemCis or GemCarbo. We need trials to look at this question. And again, I think the future is very, very bright for this disease, where we really had no options a number of years ago, and now we have multiple ones. Thank you.
So a few final questions, and I'll come back to Gus in a second, see if he has any questions. One thing I never thought to ask anybody, Dan, with that pretzel, it's put in cystoscopy-wise, and it's a tube when they put it in, right? So does it, like, how does it become a pretzel? It just flips out, or what?
It just sits there. It's actually very small. So it goes in through the cystoscope, and it...
But when you put it in, it's like a pretzel shape?
It's like a pretzel.
It auto-assembles.
Oh, it auto. Yeah,
that's why you stretch it out, and then it naturally curls.
Yeah. Right. So, Terry, we have the breast cancer people waiting here in the sidelines here who use TDXD. They're looking for any HER2, you know, like a 1-plus is good. How much HER2 do you need to see in order to use a TDXD?
Huge question. And for a while, we thought it was only going to be the HER2 3-plus patients. There was actually data for disitamab vedotin, which Dan just talked about, that showed actually decent response rates in HER2 1-plus patients. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we're just beginning to understand this. We're actually inviting breast cancer doctors to the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network meeting this summer to teach us about how to think about HER2 and how to develop these drugs.
Yeah, we actually did video of Hope Rugo and pumped it into AUA last year, right? Because like they're the only people who really understand. Well, I want to ask you also, Terry, about dostatinib vedotin in terms of tolerability and that versus TDXD as you see things moving forward. I'm guessing you don't see ILD with dostatinib vedotin, though.
I think it's lower. I don't think it's zero, but it's
right?
Lower. Yeah, I think Dan alluded to this. Because dostatinib vedotin has MMAE as the payload, it's the same payload as EV. So we don't really know, can patients go from EV to DV or the reverse, both from a side effect perspective, but also from a treatment resistance when we think about biology. Like, if the tumor is resistant to EV, is it because of the payload or is it because they lose Nectin-4? I actually think it's the payload. So it's not so clear how effective these drugs will be in sequence. And that might be a good rationale for giving TDXD as a next-line therapy.
Gus, any thoughts or questions?
Actually, well, two thoughts. One is more of an observation. Earlier this morning, Dr. O'Malley showed in his slide the persistence or the presence of the HER2 expression. Number one in the columns, because he was in the ovarian section, number one was bladder. And the reason why it caught my attention is because our FCS doctors, I mean, Dr. Petrulak mentioned that the study in the sitomab vedotin in China, well, our FCS doctors have enrolled already 6 patients in a sitomab vedotin study in the U.S., of course. So I have zero. It's Amir Harandis, our PI, so I want to call out to him because he's paying the quota for U.S. patients.
Yeah, I mean, it's so exciting to be able to offer people, you know, trials with new agents, and it's not like, quote, the old days when we were doing chemo A versus chemo B, everything is approved versus approved. People are going into remission in phase 1 studies nowadays, so it's a great opportunity for our patients. All right, we're going to move on. Thanks so much.